Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, a big city district attorney on criminal justice reform. In 2017, when Larry Krasner was elected Philadelphia's DA, he came from an unusual background for the job. He had spent his career as a civil rights and defense attorney, not a prosecutor. Instead of the typical tough-on-crime talk, he promised to reform the system. He took on cops, he said he would end cash bail, and he advocated for the Black Lives Matter movement. Krasner became a nationally known figure for his work, but now he's up for re-election and is facing a tough primary challenge. Larry Krasner's new book is titled For the People, A Story of Justice and Power. He's also the subject of the new PBS documentary titled Philly DA. I spoke with him Friday morning. First of all, I'd be most interested in your reaction to this week's guilty verdict in Minneapolis of Derek Chauvin.
You know, I think a lot of people in law enforcement, and that's what I do, were very trepidatious about what happened. A lot of us believed that this was a case in which guilt was clear, and that if there was an acquittal, there would be unrest coast to coast. You know, I was gratified to see the verdict. It was not one guilty, it was three guilties. It was guilty on all the charges, which I thought was legally 100% justified. But also, you know, we had essentially no violent unrest around the United States. This is obviously only one drop in a bucket of police killings where there has not been justice. But it was wonderful for me to see the little bit of justice that you can get in a courtroom happen.
What kind of sentence would you expect given the verdict of guilty on all three counts?
Not being an expert in Minnesota law, I would be really conjecturing, but I can tell you this. We have seen in a somewhat similar case in Texas a verdict of about 15 years. I think most people would expect on a case like this that it looks like more than 10 years and probably not 40 years. I think that would probably be a range that people would expect. But again, I'm not speaking as someone with expertise in Minnesota law.
You know, your book does not paint a very pretty picture of the way our legal system works. Was that exactly what you intended?
What a great question. I think what I intended was to tell true stories. It was to kind of have a conversation, the same conversation I had with juries, the same conversation I had when I was campaigning. And the book really does cover the span of my campaign to become district attorney in 2017. That's a conversation I had on the campaign trail. It is the conversation people had back with me about that was full of stories about real people. I just wanted to continue that conversation with people who might not be in the system. There was certainly no intent to paint it a certain way. I must tell you that when I first became a lawyer and dedicated my career to criminal justice, I did not think the system was as bad as it is. Those were a series of learnings, a series of awakenings during my career, things that I learned in the process of representing people. So there certainly was not an intent to paint a gloomy picture, but there was an intent to paint the situation in a way that is real and is colorful.
Have you ever seen a national outcry, the likes of which has been given regarding the George Floyd case and the trial of Derek Chauvin?
That's a wonderful question. And I think there are two answers. The answer for most white people, and I'm a white person, is no. The answer for most Black people and many brown people is yes, that this has been an outcry nobody else heard that goes back decades. And I'm not trying to be dramatic here, but it goes back centuries. You know, one of the things that I learned being a civil rights attorney, and I started my career, you know, I started my career in criminal defense. I was a public defender. Then I did private criminal defense work for 25 years with my own firm. But my, you know, I also spent about 20% of my time representing civil rights plaintiffs from about 1990 until I was in office. And what I saw over and over and over is that what happened to George Floyd is a reality that is well known in the Black community. It's well known in the brown community, well known to poor people, you know, of all races and all backgrounds. It's well known to them. There's nothing new here except a very compelling piece of video that makes it impossible for people who don't want to believe to look away. So this is an outcry that was not heard before, but it is now being heard partly because of the video in ways it was not heard before by, frankly, white people.
That very compelling piece of video makes me wonder whether a sentence of 15 years for the killing of George Floyd would satisfy those who have been protesting, not just, as you say, the George Floyd case, but many throughout this century.
You know, it probably will not satisfy everyone, but, you know, I do want people to understand that our American frame of reference allows widely varying and wildly varying sentences for homicide. There are countries, including modern Germany, where every single person, no matter what they are convicted of doing as a crime, is considered for parole at 15 years. Doesn't mean they'll get it, but they are considered for parole. There are countries that have outlawed the death penalty. Germany is one of them. There are countries that have outlawed sentences of life without parole. Being in the most incarcerated country in the world, our frame of reference is sentences of life without parole, even for juveniles. I mean, we used to sentence juveniles to death in the United States. So our frame of reference is quite different. And I think sometimes people equate a sentence with the valuation of a human life. They think that somehow we're proving we love a victim more if we say the death penalty, as opposed to saying some number of years in jail that is less than that. I'm not taking a position on what the sentence should be. That's something that should be very carefully considered. It should be a balanced consideration in light of every single factor in the case. But it, you know, I think as with almost all sentencings and something that is as dramatic, emotional, and frankly, nationally important as this, there are some who are dug in that no sentence is enough. And some are dug in that any sentence at all is an outrage. And then the rest of us are somewhere in between.
How do you think the judge handled the case?
I have mixed feelings about it. You know, I thought some of his comments, like his comment about Maxine Waters, were really unnecessary. I'm not clear on whether he is going to be terribly fair and balanced on sentencing. We'll find that out when it comes around. But I will say this, in general, the trial took a while, but didn't take forever. So that is a good sign. And in general, the proceedings were orderly. We didn't see some of the mayhem that I remember seeing in the trial of O.J. Simpson, different case, obviously, but the trial of O.J. Simpson, where it went on forever and things got out of hand. So I think it was an orderly process. We'll have a better measure of this judge when we see the sentence.
I was so interested to read about your sitting on a jury, obviously, before you even went to law school in a possible death penalty case, and how the jurors, when they began their deliberations, how one juror revealed himself. Do you recall that story?
Oh, yes. That is a moment in my life that is hard to forget. So I had just come out of college. I was not quite sure with what to do with the rest of my life. So I took a year off and was working essentially as a carpenter's assistant. When I got subpoenaed for jury duty, turned out I was picked for a jury in the rape murder of a woman whose house was burned down around her. And the man who did it was actually caught close by. He was in her stolen car. He was staying in a motel. And on one of the mirrors was his thumbprint in her blood. So this was a case that was not really a whodunit. It was pretty clear what had happened. Her son, by the way, was an FBI agent. So after she was killed, the area was flooded with FBI agents and other law enforcement personnel. And therefore, his apprehension was pretty quick. So we heard the trial, and in a death penalty case in Pennsylvania, first you go out to decide on innocence versus guilt, and then if it's a first-degree murder verdict, you'll go out for a second phase to decide whether or not the defendant deserves a sentence of death or a sentence of life without possibility of parole. So we go out right after we've heard all the evidence. We are getting ready to decide the issue of whether he's guilty or not guilty on these charges. And one of our quieter members stood up and he pulled a little Bible out of his back pocket, which he held out in front of him upside down, was the first thing I noticed. Opened it up, and then he started to kind of mumble something about to the effect of, who am I to sit in judgment? My mother was actually a minister, and so I immediately recognized the biblical reference, even though I don't think he was on the right page. So we all kind of got quiet, because they ask you questions about this during jury selection, whether you can sit in judgment on another person. Do you have a religious conviction that would prevent you from doing that? And he must have answered all those questions, sure, I can do this, or he wouldn't be on the jury. So we asked him questions, and we pretty quickly realized that he was not well. Something was not going well with him mentally, and we let the judge know what was happening. And soon enough, instead of being 12 jurors, we were 11.
You had actually seen him at dinner the night before with his menu upside down.
I had seen him at a meal the day before. He was sitting next to me, and the reason he was next to me is that this was such a high-profile jury that they had sequestered the jury in the same way they did with the Derek Chauvin trial. We were all living together in a hotel, and we were dining together under the watchful eyes of court personnel to make sure no one came up to pressure us or slip us a note or something. And I noticed as he sat next to me that he seemed to be holding his menu upside down. You know, I thought it was a little odd. I corrected it for him, but I just figured he was tired out from a long week away from family or whoever he might have at home. But then when I saw him do this in the room, we realized something was up. It turned out what had happened is during jury selection, he did not want to reveal he had mental illness. He did not want to reveal he was taking psychotropic medication. So he had lied when he was asked those questions, and not realizing, of course, that he was going to end up being sequestered in a hotel, he had no access to those medications. So over the course of the week it took to try the case, he started to decompensate. And just right after we went out for deliberations, he wasn't well, which resulted in his removal. That was not the only bit of excitement in that jury room. I heard more than one racist comment in that jury room, one of them about the defendant who was Black, another one about a juror who was of a different background. And, you know, I think I saw some of the real frailty on a jury, but I also saw some of its genius. There were people back there who remembered different details just because of how their minds worked. There were people there who were very, very rational and thoughtful about analyzing certain parts of the testimony and looking for possible flaws in them. But I'll tell you what I knew for sure. What I knew for sure was that the process by which we decide whether someone else should live or die is not perfect. And that stuck with me. It stuck with me many years later when I was a criminal defense attorney and I was representing people in death penalty cases when the court appointed me. And I would accept some of these court appointments, which pretty much made me broke. But, you know, it was God's work. It had to be done. And once again, I saw how imperfect the system was. And it wasn't just the juries. It was a system that deliberately underpays criminal defense attorneys who do these cases, that doesn't want to pay for experts, doesn't want to pay to get school records and go interview witnesses to find out about the life of the person that is being considered. And, you know, once again, I saw that it was not perfect. And then here I am now in office as an elected prosecutor with the power to determine whether or not to seek the death penalty. And we have had to, in the line of work, analyze the history of the death penalty in Pennsylvania and make some decisions. And what we have found, frankly, is that the death penalty in Pennsylvania for the last 40 years, especially in our look at Philadelphia, the death penalty is not imposed as the law requires on the worst offenders for the worst homicides. The death penalty is imposed, and by imposed, I mean sentenced. They don't actually carry it out in Pennsylvania, only very rarely. But the death penalty has been imposed. It has been given. The sentence has been given for the last 40 years, more to people who killed white victims, more to defendants who are Black or brown, more to defendants who are broke, and more to defendants who are mentally impaired. Not at all necessarily to the worst offenders for the worst crimes.
So this is why you call criminal justice reform the most important civil rights issue of our time. Define criminal justice reform.
Well, let me say this. You know, I think one inescapable fact is that we consider ourselves the land of freedom. We can't stop saying justifiably negative things about someone like Vladimir Putin. But the most incarcerated country in the world is not run by Vladimir Putin. It is run by the President of the United States. How can you be the land of freedom and simultaneously be the most incarcerated country in the world with some of the most draconian sentencing? You know, let me give you another example, because Philadelphia in many ways is the archetype for this. Philadelphia is a place that has national parks dedicated to our somewhat mixed but somewhat glorious history of documents relating to freedom. And when I say mixed, we all know what I'm talking about. It's slavery being built into these documents. But, you know, Philly has National Park dedicated essentially to the United States Constitution, the Declaration of Independence. We have the Liberty Bell here. Most incarcerated of the 10 largest cities. Most oversupervised in terms of probation and parole of the 10 largest cities. And this is also the city in the world that had more juveniles given sentences of life without possibility of parole than any other city in the world. And I say that because it had more than any city in the United States, and other countries don't even do this. Countries that we call authoritarian, that we look down on, don't even do this, right? There is a lie that we are telling ourselves that this is the land of freedom unless we are willing to confront the reality that we're the most incarcerated country, and we do things in this country that other countries won't even think about doing in terms of our own citizens and the power of government against them.
More of my conversation with Larry Krasner when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Larry Krasner. He's Philadelphia's district attorney. His new book is titled For the People, A Story of Justice and Power. So what would be the first major change you would wish to make in our criminal justice system from what we know now?
First major change I would like to see is a very substantial reduction in our mass incarceration and every dime saved invested into the things that we know do a better job at preventing crime. And those things are public education. They are the recreation of a decimated mental health system. It is efforts towards dealing with the disease that is addiction. And it would be using those funds, reinvesting those funds essentially into economic development. That's where it has to start. You know, the same principle applies to other aspects of our system. It's not just the jails, it's policing. Philadelphia has chronic violence, chronically high violence. We got more guns on the street than ever for lower prices, more drugs on the street than ever for lower prices after decades of the most draconian prosecution. And after decades of having a police department that's actually bigger than the city, meaning we are the sixth largest city, but we have the fourth largest police department in the United States. We need to take some of the resources that are being put into policing, and we need to shift them. Why do we ask our police officers to be the first responders for mental health issues? It's a disaster. It's unfair to our police officers. They are not trained for it. We recently had the killing of a mentally ill person who came out of his house holding a knife. He was killed in slightly over 1 minute from the time he walked out the front door of his house. You know, his family wasn't calling the police so they would kill him. They were calling because they needed help and they needed mental health help with them. So we just need to shift resources to things that work. We need to do to criminal justice what was done to medicine a long time ago, which is shift resources to prevention, not to the kind of interventions that come after the harm.
So you shifted from becoming a public defender, and you are now the district attorney, but you're certainly facing some pushback over your own approach and the results to date. People are criticizing you, saying crime has not gone down, it's gone up. People are facing more people are going to jail. Tell me what your own thoughts are about what's happening.
You know, we anticipated plenty of resistance because that is what happens in a social justice movement. And I have always analyzed this as being a grassroots movement for criminal justice reform that is electing progressive prosecutors around the country to carry it out. Lawyers don't lead movements. People lead movements. Lawyers help people who are leading movements. And so when Kim Fox got elected in Chicago as their progressive prosecutor before me, she was the technician, in my opinion, picked by Cook County, Illinois, Chicago, to help them with that. Same thing with Aramis Ayala, who also got there before me in Orlando, Florida. They were the ones who were picked to do it. Well, that was sort of toward the beginning of this whole thing. If you look now, 10% of the United States has elected a progressive prosecutor, and they have done so in some of the biggest jurisdictions, including the biggest jurisdiction for criminal justice in the United States.
A progressive prosecutor, meaning the kinds of ideas you've just spelled out.
Yes, meaning people who want to shrink the footprint of traditional law enforcement in the most incarcerated country in the world, who want that money to be reinvested in things that we're quite sure are going to work much better. So, you know, that movement is underway and it is important and it's in some of the biggest cities. And what we actually see is a lot of progress, which I'll mention, but the big surprise, of course, was the pandemic. The pandemic has had a sweeping effect. And the truth about this is it's kind of cheap politics to blame progressive prosecutors. The reality is, as we look, and I could get into the details, but it goes on forever. As we look, what is quite clear is that while we have a slight decline in crime all over the country, which we do, and we have a slight decline in violent crime all over the country, which we do, we have a terrible spike in gun murders and shootings. That's what is affecting the country. Nationally, 18% increase. Big cities, 40% increase on average. They looked at the 34 biggest cities. Well, Philadelphia's increase is 40%. It's actually the national average. And there are plenty of very traditional prosecutors in Republican cities who have had a bigger spike, but they are not subjected to this criticism because some people are, frankly, making a cheap politics out of what is a national tragedy, and they're trying to claim causation that isn't there. The real causation here is actually quite straightforward because it explains why this is happening all over the country, including in areas with a lot of cornfields. The reason it's happening all over the country is simply because all of this protective layer we've had for young people has broken down. So high school classrooms closed, athletics in and out of school, shut down job programs, summer camps, swimming pools, recreation centers, all sorts of counseling and treatment, houses of worship. They're all closed. You know, I'm 60 years old and they are all closed for the first time in my life while we simultaneously have shut down the courts and much of policing and much of probation and parole. So we're seeing a national phenomenon. The common thread is that as society opens up, we should not merely restart these things. We should be doubling our investment in these things because we now see how protective they really are.
But you're getting lots of pushback from the police force itself.
Well, I like basically every progressive prosecutor in the country, I'm getting a lot of pushback from the police union, which is different than the police force. Let us look, for example, at George Gascon. Mr. Gascon was the DA in San Francisco. He is now the DA in the biggest criminal justice jurisdiction. George Gascon is in LA and he is the progressive prosecutor. What was his career before he became a DA? He was a cop. He was a police officer. He was chief of police in Mesa, Arizona. He was the chief of police in San Francisco, where he picked up a law degree. And then when Kamala Harris left that position, he was appointed to it, right? Police unions hate George Gascon, a career police officer and career police chief. And they don't hate him because he's a bad person. They hate him because he wants to change the way things are done.
You are facing a Democratic primary on May 18th. The police union strongly favors your opponents. How would you describe the stakes as you see them?
Well, the stakes are high, but the stakes are high because this is a movement that is spreading, and a setback would be a very bad thing for this movement. But let me be clear so we all understand. The stakes are also high because the leader of the police union in Philadelphia, like most unions, is the voice of the past. He is answering for the retired membership because most of the members of police unions are not current active police officers. They are retired members. What that means in a town like Philly is you are having a very, very racist and brutal history play out in their opinions and who they select. So it therefore is really no surprise that the leader of the Philadelphia Police Union has called Black Lives Matter, quote, a pack of rabid animals, unquote. I mean, that's word for word, that he has been welcoming to the Proud Boys at the FOP Hall, where Proud Boys went in and drank beers in the officers only section of a bar there, a fact he denied until the Proud Boys, being Proud Boys, put it up on social media. And there they were doing all of that. This is before the insurrection happened. This is also, a leader of the Fraternal Order of Police who has justified the wearing of Nazi tattoos on a police officer visibly while in uniform, right? I am not going to get along with that. It would be immoral for me to get along with that. Among other things, my dad served in World War II. I'm not going to get along with that. I shouldn't. This is to some extent a fight over the soul of policing. Someone like that is not serving the active membership of the police department well. On the other hand, my relationship with the commissioner is generally quite good, this commissioner and the last commissioner. Commissioner actually runs the police department, not somebody who's hanging out at a union hall and hasn't seen a police car in 15 years. So we're getting along, I think, rather successfully in many ways. We don't agree on everything, but we agree on a lot.
So to what extent do you see your own upcoming primary as something of a litmus test for progressives nationwide?
I think it is a race that will be closely watched. Kim Fox's reelection 2 years ago was closely watched. There was a concerted effort nationally to defeat her. She won anyway. George Gascon was not the incumbent, but he overcame the incumbent last year. That was the most watched DA's race that year. And Philadelphia's will be the most watched DA's race this year. I don't say that out of any sense of pride or anything. It's just reality that national forces are trying to push this back, and they're going to fail. And the reason they're going to fail is that while a lot of the institutions are not with us, which is normal with a social justice movement, the people are, which is also normal with a social justice movement. I'll just give you a sample of why I consider this to be a fight that is a 16-hour-a-day fight from now till the end, but I'm not worried. The number of low-dollar donations that we have received as opposed to my opponent in the Democratic primary is 20 to 1. For people donating less than $50, we got 20 of them for every one that he has. Yes, he has the support of the leadership of a union that twice backed Donald Trump. Yes, he has $500,000 sitting in a PAC, which was donated by a man who gave $20 million to Donald Trump. But this is a city that hates Donald Trump. We got 7 Democrats for every one Republican. We don't do Donald Trump. So, when I see that, when I see people who don't have $1,000 to give or $500 or even $100, when I see people who got $49 or less to give, going in their pocket, 20 of them for every one that my opponent has, that says to me, the people are with us. Our issue is bringing around the institutions, be they political, media, some of the other criminal justice institutions, or some throwback union leadership like we have with our FOP, our Fraternal Order of Police in Philadelphia. We don't have a problem with people. We have the people.
Larry Krasner, thank you. It's good to be with you.
Thank you, Diane. It's wonderful to talk to you.
That was Larry Krasner. He's Philadelphia's district attorney. His new book is titled For the People, A Story of Justice and Power. He's also the subject of the new PBS Independent Lens documentary, Philly DA. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Sandra Baker, and Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.